Allison, what were you doing for your paper again? I know I approved it.
Healthcare,
that's right. Abby, do you know what you're going to write about?
No, I'm so sorry. I'm sick all last week. Can I email it to you later?
Yes. Remember, it has to be something related to state and local. Enrique?
Yeah.
Just trying to get the names and the faces. What's your topic for your paper?
Speed limits.
Speed limits? Okay. Interesting. Because that is both a local and a state concern. And in some instances, you could tie in the federal government as well. Because if you're talking speed limits on highways. So, yeah, I think you're going to be able to have a lot of access to good information. And they approve next door, so. Let me see. That's not you, that's not you. Are you Emanuela? All right, see, I'm working it. Your topic?
State police.
Police. Yep, I remembered. I did approve that via email. Yeah. Okay, very good. All right, so the recorder's rolling.
This is not on. So what we're going to do, we'll finish the first unit, and then again, information, just the intro to political science, and just some general concepts to remember. That pretty much coincides with chapter one. Now we're moving on to federalism, and the evolution of federalism. That some of the things that we're going to talk about coincide with what's in chapter two. The other thing that I want to reiterate is that on my website, proflomatic.com, down where the outlines are, there is a handout, the advantages and disadvantages of federalism. Please give that a couple of reads. Get that information into your head, because we don't have time, unfortunately, to do an analysis of it, full-blown. All right, there we go. All right, now, all of the topics that we cover were kind of challenging in that in order to make sense of how we got here, you got to kind of, or what's going on here is we got to figure out how we got here. So we're going to have to do a little historical analysis. Just to help us understand, you know, kind of like what was the intent. And then kind of where change occurred along the way. Are you Heather? No.
No, I'm Dana.
You're Dana. All right. Were you here last class?
No.
Okay, I didn't think so. Did you figure out what you want to write your paper about? Good morning.
Yeah, I emailed you. I forgot to send it on Friday.
Okay. Oh yeah, because that would be the police powers, because that involves the health code. So banning of rodents.
Yeah.
Oh, so you can't buy rats and guinea pigs anymore.
Yeah, no, but we don't take care of them. They like the way they're bred, a lot of them get cancer and die early.
Oh, okay. So you're looking to ban it. Okay. So, all right.
In like large chains, like Transmart.
Yep. For real?
Yeah, there's like specific places where they like have bigger rats, but it's not like they do it at PetSmart, they do it differently.
Oh, well, all right. So we'll call that kind of like animal regulation or something along those lines. So now keep in mind, it's my expectation that you write a paper that's kind of like fact driven. So what you might need to do is, if this is something that doesn't exist in any other states, you might want to kind of compare it to maybe other species where there's some type of regulation, where the government basically says you can and you cannot.
There's that with dogs right now.
Yeah. So again, you have the ability to make an analogy, a comparison. So, yeah. And of course, if you run into a stone wall and you can't find enough information, you're always welcome to change your topic. You just got to let me know. But I'm going to call it topic approved because, again, animal regulations is one of the police powers that states are allowed to regulate. So, very good. All right, are you Heather?
Yep.
All right, very good. Heather, did you figure out what you wanted to write your paper about? Give it some thought and send me an email.
Okay.
All right. Very good, very good, very good. Okay, so federalism. Federalism is commonly defined as a system of government where power is shared between the central government and its component parts. There are many different forms of federalism. There are many countries that do use a version or a type of federalism. Again, just to go back to the definition, it's where power is shared between a central government and the component parts. In the United States, we know what the component parts are. We have a system of government where power is shared between the national government, the state governments, and ultimately the people that make up the local governments. You know, ultimately, unlike other forms of government, the average person in our country, average citizen, does wield the capability to impact the way government operates. Well, that's not true in some of the other alternatives, such as the form of government that's utilized in the United Kingdom, for example. Parliament in London wields absolute authority over the local or provincial governments in the empire. Local governments in England are not allowed to make laws. All of the rules and regulations come from the state, the central government. So ultimately, the national government removes that authority. Another system of government that does exist, we actually had one. Our first national government was a confederacy, a confederation. As we're going to see under the first frame of government called the Articles of Confederation. Our national government was actually below the power of the states, the component parts. But in a true federal system, power is shared. Power is shared. Question. All right, you, sir? What's your name? Elise. Here you are. Did you send me your topic for your paper? What are you going to write about? Please send me an email before day's end. Because they were due on Friday. Okay. Now, as far as federalism in our country, it has changed. It has morphed. It has evolved. Because after all, we're coming up on the 250th anniversary of our country. Times change. People's attitudes change. And as a result, our system of government has changed. from where it was to what it began, or became. Of course, the most significant change was that the Founding Fathers actually created a government and realized it didn't work. So they scrapped it. Articles of Confederation. This system was created during the midst of the War for Independence. These articles were proposed by a gathering of representatives of originally the colonies, but they would become the states, called the Continental Congress. And these representatives drafted this frame of government during the chaos of the War for Independence. And it took nearly 5 years for the states to adopt it. But if you ever have the opportunity to read the articles, you will see that it clearly states within it that it's the states, not the people, who are represented by the national government. The people are not referenced at all. And the national government was restricted from interfering in the lives of the people. And it could only do so if the states wanted that interference. The states actually had the ability to say no. So, for example, the most common, if you took this, if you studied the articles in American history when you're in high school, or maybe you've taken it here, one of the common, most common examples used to criticize this frame of government was in the collection of taxes. Obviously, government needs to collect taxes to provide the services that the people demand. Well, under the Articles of the Confederation, the national government did not have the power to tax. What the government had to do is essentially request. They had to ask the states to contribute. Now, I think it was 1786, might have been 85, 86, the year doesn't matter. But there was one year that France and the Netherlands, you know, were making their demands for a debt payment. Because don't forget, we only won our independence because we borrowed money. So the national government asked the states to contribute. I think they had to pay something like $700,000 or something like that. It was a large amount of money. Well, that particular year, the states only sent like $76. So, you know as well as I do, if you have a credit card, you know what happens to you if you don't make payments. You know, credit card's coming after you. Company's coming after you. If it's a car payment, you know, they're going to come and repo your car. You know, it's insane. Well, we have this national government that owes money to other nations, and it has no money. And the more the national government asked, the more the state said, no, go pound sand. And there was nothing the national government could do about it. So, it was the taxation issue, it was the regulation of interstate commerce, it was foreign policy, and it was many, many, many issues that basically exposed the fact that the articles didn't work. So the Founding Fathers realized, okay, our first attempt is failing. If we don't do something, what could occur? Well, the United States could break apart. England was still sniffing around, hoping that we failed. They believed that some of the states would want to come back into the Union, or the Empire.
states like Massachusetts and Rhode Island actually almost went to war with one another over interstate commerce. Heck, Massachusetts itself almost had a revolution. The Shays Rebellion. Did you ever learn about that? The government in Boston was crushing the citizens of Massachusetts. Kind of like our current government is. But back then, those guys were so fed up with it, they actually took up arms. Out in Springfield, a militia marched upon a federal arsenal, like a military base, to try to seize guns and powder and cannon. Well, the governor actually rallied the state militia and marched out there, and shots were fired. People died. So not only was the national government not able to regulate the states were fighting against one another, and in some of the states, there were uprisings. It was bad. So if at first you don't succeed, try again. The founders went back to the drawing board and would attempt to create a new government. The Constitution of the United States. In the Constitution, the sovereign power rested in the hands of the people. Again, if you've ever read the U.S. Constitution, the preamble literally begins that way. We the people of the United States of America. Well, they took the power of the people and they divided it more equally between the national government and the states. But they also made sure that the national government was strong enough to be able to deal with all of the problems that the nation faced in the 1780s. The national government had the power to tax the states. The national government had the power to regulate interstate commerce. And under the Supremacy Clause, the United States law in the Constitution was put above all of the states. But here's the thing. What does that mean? Having the power over, what does that mean? And how much power do you give? Well, on that, interestingly enough, the founders were divided. They all recognized the Articles wasn't working. We had to do something better. We all recognized that we had to elevate the national government up. But how much power do we give? Well, my friends, this simple question still divides our country today. This is the core of the majority of political issues that we face. Hell, I don't want to be controversial, but it's been on the news. All of the shenanigans that are going on out in Minnesota. The mayor, the governor, is basically saying they have a right to give sanctuary to illegal immigrants. But the national government is saying, no, we have a right to go in and arrest criminals who already have extraction orders against them. And there's resistance. Who's right? Who's wrong? Well, ultimately, the national government's right. Because, again, the United States government is above. Federal law trumps state law. But is the way the national government doing it the right way? Well, I've watched plenty of talking heads on TV over the last month. I've engaged in many conversations. And I've heard from people that say, no, they're not going far enough. ICE and Department of Homeland Security. And then I've had other people say, no, they're acting like Gestapo agents. It's a divide. It's politics.
And you know, this question is never going to be able to be answered. Because the problem is we're all individuals and we all have our own opinions. And the Founding Fathers didn't give us any guidance.
Because out of the gates, right at the birth of the country, there were some who argued, no, most of the power should be in the hands of the states. And then there were others that said, no, most of the power should be in the hands of the national government. And the system they gave us creates these divisions. In an ideal world, if you read the federal government, this is what the original intent was supposed to be. A complex Venn diagram where there are clear areas of national authority, state authority, and local authority, but it also provides for concurrent issues that allow the levels of government to act or within the same sphere. I suppose that's the cleanest. Any of you know the word concurrent? You know, it's kind of like at the same time. So, for instance, the job of the national government is to defend our borders, national defense. A job at the state level, driver's license regulation. Running elections. Job of a local government, respond to a 911 call. Or pick up trash if your town has trash service. But what about roads? Who's doing the speed limit? Who's talking about doing speed limits? You have federal authority, you have state authority, and you have local authority. So, who gets the final say? You know? So, again, it's complicated. So, for instance, have you ever driven through those towns recently that done, like, road projects, like Mill Street over in Worcester? And the construction process ultimately changes the configuration of the road. You know, they're going for multimodal transportation. So roads that used to be two lanes are suddenly like narrowed down into one, and they put those granite curvings on there, and they make the bike lanes and the big wide sidewalks and all the rest, basically making it impossible for cars to drive. Well, the reason why the towns and the cities are doing that is because the state is pushing for what they call smart streets. Because the state wants to force us to stop using automobiles, and they want to force us into other means of transportation. So if the town gets the money, because the towns can't afford to fix the roads, all of the terms of the grants say they have to do this. And then in some instances, it's subject to federal regulation as well. So think of the ADA, the rules that deal with handicap, disabilities, and ways to make it so that way, you know, that there are ramps for wheelchairs, and, you know, when you have the crosswalks that blink, or emit an audio sound, so if someone is blind, you know, they can hear. You know, all of those things, those are all the result of federal regulations. Well, here's the funny thing. That all makes projects ridiculously expensive. But the federal government says, you have to put this in. The state says, you have to put this in. So guess what the local towns are forced to do? Comply if they want to get the money. So it's complicated. So there are advocates, for instance, who advocate on the part of Americans with disabilities that say, we need to add all that extra stuff in there. Even if there's never going to be a person who is blind that happens to go up to that particular intersection. But we have to do it. And then there are others that sit back and say, well, we're wasting money if there's chances that no one is ever going to use what it's designed for. But again, that's politics. That's politics. The debate.
Well,
as far as signs, men like Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, argued that if there is ever a debate where there is a concurrent issue, the states should make the decision. Because the state government is the closest to the people. But there were politicians like Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, John Adams. I said, no, we should have a nation-centered government. So if there is a concurrent issue, D.C. should decide. Well, if you look at American history, even to get the Constitution ratified, to put into effect, you started seeing in the Federalist Papers, in the Anti-Federalist Papers, arguments over this central issue. Political parties were formed over this issue. Hamilton and others made the Federalist Party. Jefferson and others made, sometimes it's called like the Jeffersonian Republicans, sometimes it's called the Republican Democrats. You know, there's a whole bunch of different ways to describe it, but just to make it simple, we'll say it was the Federalists versus the Republicans. So where the politicians were arguing with one another, ultimately issues would arise. That would become legal fights over the limits of these imaginary boundaries. Well, fortunately, unlike under the Articles and the Constitution, the Founding Fathers were smart enough to give us a branch of government that would have the final say. The Supreme Court of the United States.
Because these disputes, fortunately, did not result on blood in the streets, but rather they would end up in a courtroom. And people would argue.
And as stated in Article 3 of the Constitution, ultimately, any disputes over the meaning of the Constitution must be determined by the Supreme Court of the United States. The most significant period that would give rise to trying to define the boundaries between national power and state power would take place during the first four decades of the 19th century. And that period corresponds with a period known as the Marshall Court.
Why is it called that way?
Well, in 1801, John Marshall was approved to be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And he would be an architect that would have lasting impact on the direction that our country would go.
John Marshall was a veteran of the Revolutionary War. He was with Washington at many of the winter encampments. He saw how the states refused to give adequate aid to the Continental Army, because the states themselves were caught up in self-survival, greed. So his experience is he brought that with him when he got on the Supreme Court. And ultimately he decided, no, the only way for the country to survive is to shift the pendulum. He was a Federalist. I'm going to give you a couple of significant Supreme Court cases. You don't have to remember the facts. You just got to remember, ultimately, why these cases are significant. Because in these series of rulings, Marshall would take the Venn diagram and would shift it on its side. It would make the national government more authoritative over the states.
The first is Marbury v. Madison. Any of you study Marbury v. Madison in high school or another college class here? This is a classic example. Classic example of Marshall's rationale.
Give you the backstory. So, you had the political election of 1800. It was one of the, if not the most controversial election in the history of our country. You had the Vice President of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, running against the President of the United States, John Adams, at a time when politics were abound. Jefferson barely wins. Because while he got more electoral votes than John Adams, it was actually a tie between Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr. And as it was, the House of Representatives had to decide who won. And they threw the election to Jefferson. Controversial in itself. But Inauguration Day used to be in April. So John Adams, even though he lost the election in November, was still president for another 6 months. And one of the things that he did on his way out the door was to begin rapidly filling open federal government positions. He filled the courts with a group known as the Midnight Judges. They were all kind of appointed in the last minute. He also started appointing justices of the peace, federal agents that would have 6-year contracts. Well, one of the guys that got the job was Marbury, William Marbury. He and about 50 or 60 others applied for the job. They were all Federalists. John Adams gave them the job. Their contract was drafted. The President of the United States signed them all and affixed his seal to it, stamped it. But in order for the jobs to become official, the contracts had to be delivered to Congress. Well, in the chaos of the last days of the Adams presidency, the contracts were not delivered. They were actually left in the desk of the Secretary of State.
Why did the Secretary of State for John Adams not deliver the contracts? Here's the weird twist. Because John Adams, Secretary of State, was John Marshall. But John Marshall was one of the people that were appointed, one of the Midnight Judges. And John Marshall was appointed to become the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And no interim Secretary of State was appointed. Oops. Well, Marbury and the other guys knew they got the jobs. They knew they had a contract. They knew that it was signed and sealed. But they never received the contract. So they sued. And who did they sue? They sued Thomas Jefferson, who became president about 2 weeks later. They sued his Secretary of State, James Madison. Now, did they want money? Were they seeking to have James Madison arrested? No. What they did was put in a request for what is known as a writ of mandamus.